broadcasting from the UNMC College of Nursing. Get ready for RN Huddle, the podcast dedicated to bringing hot topics for and by nurses to the table.
Well, welcome to today's podcast. I have the distinct honor of interviewing, or actually discussing, I don't get to interview this lady. Ana De Jesus is a nutritionist who's going to be joining us today, talking about, I think, a very important aspect of pressure injury prevention and treatment. But if you follow this work, you know, I always start with what's in my mailbox. So here's what's in my mailbox. It's a note from a nurse who works in a hospital, and she writes and says, I'm consulted to see patients with various types of wounds, including pressure injuries, and I commonly find that the staff have misidentified, mislabeled, misdiagnosed, including physicians, what this wound actually is. How do I fix that? Well, that's actually a very common occurrence, is what I wrote back and said. There's a lot of people who have very minimal education in wound identification. You probably have more than many of the people you're working with. But I think the issue, the underlying issue is, you know, how do I maintain a collegial relationship with someone and at the same time say, hang on, you got this wrong. So a couple ways to do that. One is to say, upon reassessment, so this is in the narrative section of your notes, upon reassessment, this wound is a, you know, and then fill it in. And it's important to educate. So because I see the following attributes, or examining the photo which I've attached, this wound is a pressure injury. And then your prescription for treatment will make sense, because if you follow the other person's diagnoses, your treatment plan isn't going to make any sense. So I think it does two things. It clarifies the record and it helps educate that other provider. I would caution you also to make sure at the end of your notes, you say, please notify me if this wound does not continue to heal. And that way you are notified sooner than what you might have planned to come back and see the patient. Well, let me jump into what we're here about. I want to introduce to you Ana De Jesus, give her a chance to introduce herself. And then we're going to talk about what's the role of nutrition in pressure injury prevention and pressure injury treatment. I can't think of a better guest. Ana, welcome to the podcast. Please introduce yourself to the audience.
Thank you so much, Joyce. Hello, everybody. I'm Ana De Jesus, and I am so truly honored to be here. I am the president of Food and Nutritional Solutions, and I'm in Tempe, Arizona, and I'm actually currently the treasurer of NPIAP, so very exciting role. Just a little background, I have been in the healthcare industry for over 35 years, so yes, I am dating myself, and I've worked as a clinical dietitian, food service director, regional dietitian, and I've worked in all kinds of transitions of care, from acute care to long-term care, post-acute, assisted living, home care, hospice, etc. So yes, been around a lot with lots of stories. Thank you, Joyce.
Ana, what you're telling us is people eat in every setting. That's what you're telling us.
They should, right?
Exactly. So what I want to talk to you about today, and I guess I have to share a little bit of a personal story. I worked as a burn nurse for a number of years. And it was amazing how many calories those patients needed. I can remember specific cases where we tube fed them at night, did hyperalimentation during the day, and they ate orally, trying to get somewhere near 5,000 calories into those patients. I can remember a patient more recently who had a very large non-healing wound and was eating, but the wound wasn't infected. It just wasn't healing. So they did indirect calorimetry on the guy and actually came up with a caloric burning rate of over 4,000 calories. And when we fed him, he started to heal. The other group I see in my own practice is the head injured patient. And it seems like the head injured patient for me always had a hypermetabolic state because it was the brain. But I don't see a lot of prescription or effort to feed these people. So what's the role in pressure injury prevention and nutrition? Where do they belong together? And if so, how important is that connection? Because I think we're missing it.
Yes, you are absolutely right, Joyce. I love the talk about the burn unit, how many calories, because nutrition, yes, nutrition is crucial, right? The way I talk to people about nutrition is you need food to survive. You need food, you need water to survive. So really food or nutrition has three primary functions. Number one is survival, right? We need food, water to eat to survive. Number two is growth and healing. So that's where we heal, that's where the pressure injuries heal, etc. And the last is reproduction. You bring up the analogy or the discussion on burn patients needing 4,000, 5,000 calories because they are in such a hypermetabolic state. So when you bring that up, probably sometimes what is easier to think of as an analogy too is, do you like sports?
I do love sports.
You love sports.
I'm in Nebraska. It's football, football, and then football.
There you go. So just sometimes it's easier to think of our athletes, football, and they are playing all the time. They are expending so many calories and all these calories and protein that they need. Thousands upon thousands, right? 5,000, 8,000 calories a day. So that is your burn patient, needing so many calories just to, number one, survive. So they're not eating their body essentially. And number two is for growth. So when we talk about nutrition, so again, when it comes to wound healing is we need enough calories first and foremost to keep us alive. And then when we have enough calories, be it from carbohydrates, be it from protein, from fat, once we have all that, then the body can start healing. So that's when now we need more protein. But we need energy first through carbs, through protein, through fat. Generally, as much as possible, where you want to focus on carbs and fat, not so, well, protein is important, but protein we want to spare for wound healing. Does that answer it, Joyce?
No, you support my thinking that we absolutely need food to live. I apparently have ample food. I'm living quite well overweight. I only know one dietitian in the whole world that's overweight. Every other dietitian nutritionist I've ever met is perfectly shaped, perfect BMI. So I'm on the other side of the story. So when we're thinking about analyzing a patient or a resident or a client, what should a nurse look for in order to trigger a consult to a nutritionist? Because not every setting has nutritionists on staff, and they come routinely, I know that, but they also come if you call them. So what are the triggers that nurses should, and physicians, physical therapists, the whole group, what do you want us to capture to talk to you to get you to come and see the patient? So what are the big issues?
Great question, Joyce. I know nurses are very familiar with Braden, and you've got that nutrition component there and notifying the dietitian about that. But let me tell you, there's this simple form that is actually evidence-based. And it's actually discussed in the NPI, in the actually international guidelines, the latest prevention of PI, and that is your MST. So it's called the malnutrition screening tool. It is very simple, and I'm from Arizona. So we use this in a lot of our hospitals in Arizona. Of course, we also have hospitals that are 5 hours away, right? So we have to travel 5 hours away to get there, more remote areas, and they don't use this. And we're actually promoting the use of it because it is so simple and it helps to have nurses do this. So it's called the MST. Two very basic questions. Number one, have you lost weight recently without even trying? It's a yes or no answer. And if the answer is yes, then you ask, how much did you lose? So the key is, did you lose weight? And did you lose weight without trying? So that's a two-part question. And then the second main question is, have you been eating poorly because of decrease in appetite? So are you eating or not? Again, two basic questions. And if the answer or the result is a score of two or more, then that patient is at risk of malnutrition. So very simple, very basic. If nurses can do that, again, in Arizona, we have our nurses do that. It's evidence-based. And honestly, Joyce, a lot of times the nurses probably ask these questions without even realizing it. So yes. So with those two questions, if the answer is yes, let your RD know.
So I'm thinking to myself how simple that is in the outpatient wound clinics. I mean, that's what struck me. You're right, we have the Braden in the hospital, but they don't do the Braden in the outpatient wound clinics, and yet we're looking at people who are there because of non-healing wounds. And so to ask those two questions straight away, have you lost weight? If yes, how much? And what, tell me the second question again.
Oh,
Have
have
you
you lost your appetite?
That's it. Okay. Well, I never have lost my appetite. So that's why I couldn't remember that question. So, how easy to ask those? Takes under a minute, I presume, to do that. And yet it would give you very valuable information. Wow, that's great. So, what's the guidelines say about nutrition for pressure injury prevention and treatment? I presume you were a part of that team. For those of you that are not familiar with the international guideline, this is this will be the fourth of the international guidelines. There's only five sets of guidelines that were ever done. This is the fifth of those, and it's done internationally with a group here in the US and then a group in Europe and a group called the Pan Pacific. So they from Australia to Japan and China, kind of that whole area. But there are available inputs from anybody. If you want to look at it yourself and see it in early draft, you can do that at the guideline website and add your 2 cents into the story. So, Anna, I know that you were part of the nutrition guideline. What are we going to be seeing when it comes out about prevention? And then I'm going to jump to treatment. So, go ahead and give us the hints.
All right, great. And actually, this is a great segue because the very first thing on the prevention guidelines is number one, nutrition screen. So number one, nutrition screen. So we talked about the MST and it actually discusses the malnutrition screening tool as evidence-based form to use for malnutrition screening. And really the be reason behind that when it comes to prevention of pressure injury is the main thing we're looking at is malnutrition. From the dietitian or the dietary side, because malnutrition is a risk factor for pressure injury development. I mean, I don't know, Joyce, but there's like a lot of stats out there which say one out of two older adults are either malnourished or at risk for malnutrition. And in hospitals, anywhere from 20 to 50% of hospital patients are malnourished on admission, and 10 to 65, 65% decline nutritionally while being hospitalized, and 33% of well-nourished patients become malnourished. So before I proceed, can I share a story? I want to
Yes, of
share a quick
course, because
story.
I'm going to share one with you.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in 2015, I was hospitalized. Okay, so I was hospitalized for, okay, maybe I'm oversharing, but it was diverticulitis. And a month prior, let me tell you, dietitian and albumin, right? Although albumin is not an indicator of nutritional status, but just to let you know, my labs were perfect, albumin at 4.2, which is within normal. A month later, I'm in the hospital for diverticulitis. I come in with a BMI of 20, which is normal. Doctor says you've got a little hole in your GI tract. We need to give you surgery. And I'm like, no, I do not want surgery. So I'm in hospital for 5 days, NPO for 3 to 4 because of all the tests, right? So needless to say, it healed, antibiotics, great care. When I leave the hospital, I am down to a BMI of 16, undernourished, from 20 down to 16 in 5 days. So I am one of those statistics that say 10 to 65% nutritional de decline and 33% become malnourished. So
Well,
I was one of those.
I'm sorry to hear that story, but I can tell you that it rings very true with me because I can think of a great number of the critically ill patients that I tend to focus on more. And a very common set of statements made is, well, this patient hasn't eaten in 5 days. Should we start peripheral parenteral nutrition? Five days. Wow. And, if you're in critical care, you got to buy a ticket to critical care. You don't just get placed there because there's an empty bed. So these are patients that are hypermetabolic, probably have been ill like you for several days prior to admission, maybe unconscious at the time of admission to critical care, and nutrition falls by the side. And what we started a number of years ago is our hospital nutritionist makes rounds with critical care medicine. And so we have women right now that are doing that role, but they are the ones that say, how long do you want to wait on this? Well, he's NPO. Well, we can feed him other ways. And so, yeah. So in those instances, who's the person that should be on alert? Is it the bedside nurse who should say it's been X number of days? What do you want to do?
Right. And so hopefully in these situations, there's a triggering mechanism, right? NPO for 2 or 3 days, dietitian is notified. So we can start eating. So like in my case, it was clear liquids, the whole process, clear to full, et cetera. But yes, we really rely on the nurses, the patient techs, because the dietitians, I was not seen. I was not in that high risk priority, so I was never seen. So we rely on the nurses to do that. And let me tell you, the nurses I had too, I had one Filipino nurse. So it's like, she was like, would you like, when it was time to eat, I'm like, soup, we have, you're gonna laugh. In this hospital, they didn't just have chicken soup or beef, they had pho, which is Vietnamese broth. I
Wow.
was in heaven. I was in heaven. So amazing.
Right.
I'm going off track with all these stories.
No,
But yes.
it's great though to think about the fact that there's probably a relatively easy solution to identifying either the risk of malnutrition with hospitalization or the existence of malnutrition prior to. And what you're saying is the malnutrition screening tool, asking those two questions, would identify that at-risk patient earlier than normal, perhaps. Yeah. So what
Yes.
else does the guideline have for us?
Okay, so other things on the guideline is we talked about screening and then the assessment as well as a care plan. So that's more on the dietitian side. But really, another thing is just eating a balanced diet. So very common sense, I guess. But common sense is rare, right? So eating a balanced diet and really focusing on nutrient-dense foods. So not the potato chips, but making sure that we provide them with whether it's, let's go as basic as a sandwich, where you have your carbs, your protein, you've got your fat in there, et cetera. And of course, the importance of hydration, adequate hydration. And other things that we're looking at is if a patient is malnourished or at risk for malnutrition, is recommending a supplement. So when we say supplement, we're not just saying your oral nutrition right away, the supplements that come in boxes or cans, but first starting off with always food first. If the patient is eating, let's feed them, give them more carbs, give them more protein, et cetera. And then if they are not, let's fortify the foods, let's make it nutrition dense. And if they are not eating, which a lot of times in hospitals, I mean, people don't eat, right? That's why you're in there. That's why you're in there, because not wanting to eat is not normal, which is one indication that something's wrong. So when that happens, then we look at oral supplements, because there is absolutely a need for oral supplements.
So is there a must have? You know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and the patient's hungry. The kitchen is closed. So I open up the refrigerator, you know, that's in the med room, and I see applesauce and orange juice and lemon ice up in the freezer, maybe some ice cream. Okay, what do I do in the middle of the night for a patient who's hungry? Oh, leftover tray is on the windowsill. That's right, I forgot to add that in. The dinner tray's on the windowsill, but probably gross at this point, so I'm not gonna microwave that. So what do I do?
Right. And you were right. That nourishment fridge, that pantry is really crucial. It's what do we have in there? And you're right. You've got you're lucky if you have ice cream, lemon ice for the dysphagia, right? And then if we had, so in the first place, give the patient what they want. So hopefully we have it. But probably number one that patients want is broth, soup, broth. We have hospitals that always have chicken noodle soup because it's comfort food. Chicken noodle soup, and hopefully they can have it. Crackers, graham crackers, saltines, pudding. Pudding is a nice comfort food. More and more hospitals now have supplements, like you said. So that's high calorie, high protein, but it has to be iced, right? Because otherwise it's just not going to taste good. So hopefully it is in the fridge, and if it's not, icing it. That helps a lot. But I always start with what does the patient want? And then offering them what we have available.
That's a good idea. Asking what they want, because they probably know what tastes good, sounds good, is something that they eat. So I know we're toward the end of our time on this podcast, but give us a sense of what's coming in the treatment guideline for nutrition. Seems like we've really fall off the path there.
Yeah. So when it comes to treatment, of course, with I have to default to the 2019, because I am going to guess it is not going to be, I'm not saying, because what's funny, it's a nutrition work group hasn't even started on treatment yet, but I am going to guess that it still has to do with how much calories we need, how much energy we need, how much protein, the importance of supplements, which is, again, still very similar to the 2019 guidelines, micronutrients, whether it's arginine, whether it's zinc, etc. So I suspect that is all coming in the guidelines, in the treatment part of the guidelines. But again, still, because we always talk about protein, 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 which again is crucial, right? But you need the energy first.
That's an excellent point.
Yes.
To wrap this up, I want to take you back to a statement you made about albumin and prealbumin as an indicator of malnutrition. Can you just close us off with that thought?
Oh my gosh, Joyce, this is perfect. So I bring up my story, right? Albumin 4.2, not an indicator of nutritional status, whether it's prealbumin or albumin. I came in normal a month before. I'm in the hospital. A week later, draw my blood again. Guess what my albumin is? 1.6. 1.6 in 1 month. So is albumin, prealbumin, an indicator of nutritional status? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It is an indicator of inflammation, acute inflammation. Was I inflamed? Yes. Diverticulitis, acute inflammation condition. So
perfect.
There you go.
Well, let me stop and thank Ana de Jesus for joining us today on the podcast, looking at the role of nutrition in pressure injury prevention and treatment. And as you heard her say, the assessment of risk does not need to be particularly complicated. A couple quick questions on recent intake, does weight loss, ability or desire to eat will really capture the point. regardless of the setting, everybody eats in every setting. So keeping nutrition sort of front and center. Don't rely on albumin and prealbumin as your markers, because as Anna just said, when the patient is inflamed, and every disease leads to inflammation, albumin and prealbumin go down. So let me thank our guest today, Anna De Jesus, and let me stop and thank my recording technician. She is Courtney Smith is simply wonderful. She works at the University of Nebraska in the College of Nursing in our division of continuing education and does a phenomenal job with these podcasts. So I thank you, Courtney, for the work that you do. Please join us next time on the podcast. We offer them monthly. We'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to RN Huddle. To stay connected, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at UNMCCNE, or check out unmc.edu/CNE for more program information.